All right, then we will go ahead now and move to agenda item number 8. His matters on today's agenda is Dr. McCall has requested an informal settlement conference be held.
Madam Chairman, it is timed for 11 o'clock. I'm showing 10:50.
Thank you. Yes, you are correct. I appreciate that. Let's go back. Then, since we have Ms. Galvin, do we want to see item number 14 again?
I believe Ms. Pekinon has maybe expressed a desire to go to number 9, which is the discussion of a ramp participant. Is that correct, Heidi? We want to be sure we have a full board or as close as we can.
Madam Chair, that's certainly an option. We could do that. While we still have some members present, we know that at least one member needs to leave at noon, acknowledging that this is going to be probably more than a 9-minute agenda item, but that's up to your discretion.
I would be okay with that if we could move to agenda item number 9. Given the matter requires the board to review and discuss health information and to maintain the confidentiality and identity of the ramp participant, I do move that the board meet in executive session to discuss confidential health information and to subsequently receive legal advice if needed. Do we have a second?
Seconded.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries.
Staff, if I may, Ms. Pekinon, there is a committee or a participant, C. Holver. He is an attorney with the Attorney General's office, and I would ask that you admit him into executive session, please.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Galvin. We were prepared for that possibility. And just to make sure Ms. Poe is clear, in addition to board members, counsel, and appropriate staff, we will be sending participant 2022-01 into executive session as well.
All right, I do believe we have everybody in attendance. Do we have a motion?
I'll make a motion that we proceed as discussed in executive session.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please. Do we need a roll call on that, Ms. Galvin? Okay, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
I abstain.
Okay. The motion does carry. For the participants, please note that board staff will be in contact with you this afternoon with a plan to move forward next week. They'll keep you in the loop of what the discussion.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
This is Ms. Poe. I'm going to give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is vote. Vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, I've got to leave. So I'll be stepping away at this time.
Thank you. We appreciate you sticking around. All right. We will now move to agenda item number 8, if everybody is ready. All right, agenda item number 8. The time is now 12:29 p.m. This item was timed for 11 a.m. This matter is on today's agenda as Dr. McCall has requested an informal settlement conference be held concerning complaint 23F-2047-PSY. As a reminder, this case has been remanded to a formal hearing before an administrative law judge with the Arizona Office of Administrative Hearing. The hearing is scheduled for November 17th. Ms. Galvin represents the state with respect to this matter, so Mr. Harris is serving as the board's independent legal advisor. Dr. McCall, and I see that Ms. Thibodeau is present. Can you please unmute yourself, state your name for the records, and you may proceed with your request at this time.
I'm Dr. Austin McCall.
Hi, I'm Tammy Thibodeau. I'm her attorney. And I am not sure some of these items should be discussed in a executive session. I'm not sure.
If the information does, if your request includes PHI, then yes, we would need to go into executive session.
Well, yes, the brief letter I submitted does cover personal information.
Then I'll make a motion that we go into executive session for the purpose of discussing personally identifiable health information, as well as, if needed, seeking legal advice from our attorney.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. Just clarification, I am also going to send Dr. McCall and her attorney into executive session right now.
Yes, please, as well as Ms. Galvin and Mr. Harris and yes. Mr. Hover.
Thank you.
There is a need to discuss any personally identifiable health information that we will need to go back into executive session. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Thibodeau or her, or for Dr. McCall or Ms. Thibodeau? Hearing none, we will now begin discussion and deliberation of this matter. Would there be any board member that would like to begin the discussion? Ms. Shree.
We have, you know, we've looked at this case in detail. I think we made a recommendation. And I don't at this point feel like anything's changed in the sense of the recommendation that we made. So are we looking? I don't feel compelled or don't like an informal settlement issue. I'd say we go forward with our current position.
I agree.
Those are my thoughts.
I agree.
All right. Do we have a motion?
I would make a motion then that we move. Is the motion to deny their request? I guess I'm asking for some legal, or is the motion to move forward as we have already agreed? I guess I want to make sure, because on the agenda it says regarding an informal settlement conference. So is my motion to.
And Dr. Harris or Mr. Harris, you are muted.
I warned everybody. if you, Madam Chair, members of the board, if appropriate, perhaps we could just entertain a motion to proceed to formal hearing as scheduled.
Then I'd make a motion to proceed to formal hearing as scheduled.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Do we need a roll call, Mr. Harris?
No.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. McCall and Ms. Thibodeau for being here today. All right. I do believe that another comfort break may be warranted. Would everybody like to take a comfort break to about 1 o'clock? Now that's kind of short.
Maybe we need a little bit more time. Some of us need to get some lunch too.
Yes, please. Uh-huh. Would you guys like to do 1:15?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go ahead and take a break to 1:15.
Thank you.
Bit off.
Thank you so much, Mr. Harris. We appreciate your time today. Fantastic. Dr. Stewart, have you joined?
I got to ask Ms. Michelson a question since we're still waiting. How was DC?
It was fabulous. The weather was perfect. Perfect fall colors. I got to see a lot. I walked 8 miles the first day, 11 miles a second. So I went to all the major spots. And I think my favorite was actually the Heidi's recommendation, the National Portrait Museum. And they have a section about all the presidents. And I found that to be really informative.
Good. Glad to see you back. And
but my feet are tired.
So. Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word for the meeting is candidate. Candidate. Thank you.
This sounds very election-like.
Yes.
I also see a theme going on here.
Yeah. Next meeting will be all Thanksgiving food.
Just a couple of housekeeping items. Dr. Davey did have to step off. He will be rejoining us at a later time. And I, during the break, my babysitter had a quick, rapid kind of emergent change in schedule. So the baby did just get dropped off with me again. And this was my backup babysitter. The other babysitter called in sick. So, I apologize if my camera has to go off. It's because the wee little one, is probably making her attempts to distract all of you.
So all right. Just at 6 or 7.
We do have a quorum. Yeah, we do have a quorum to continue. Now that we do have Ms. Galvin back, though, and while we're waiting for Dr. Davey, it might be a good time to revisit agenda item number 14, and that is going to be related to the EPPP and the conversations that we tabled this morning. Does anybody want to, and we do have Dr. Flint with us as well, I don't know, Ms. Pecknon, did you provide an update to Ms. Galvin, or should we start there?
Madam Chair, Ms. Galvin is aware that of some of the discussion, so I'll ask her, though, how much she wants me to sort of summarize how the discussion flowed until we tabled it.
I would appreciate a little bit more background. I got a couple of sentences over text. So. I'm going to be sure as much information as reasonable.
Very good. So this matter concerns, I'll sort of, what makes sense to me is to describe the developments in sort of a chronological order, if you will. So the Arizona Psychological Association, ASPA, submitted a letter articulating some concerns about the EPPP Part 2 requirement. And in that letter, asked for the board to give consideration to certain requests. And I know Dr. Flint would be prepared to explain or elaborate on those requests if needed. But they consist of discontinuing the requirement, waiving some fees for the examination, which, just to be clear, those fees are charged by ASPPB and not by this board. So that is essentially what ASPA would is presenting for consideration. However, then following the receipt of that letter, almost concurrently, two other events, an email began to circulate, which was appears to be a collaborative email because duplicates or identical emails were sent to perhaps all of the state boards. Certainly several of them received this letter. The letter appears to be coming to state boards through the education community, maybe the training community, again, outlining a series of concerns about the EPPP. So of course, ASPPB, meanwhile, has been gathering stakeholder input conducted town hall meetings this past summer to help inform their decision relative to whether the ACCC Part 2 would be a required component of the examination. And this predates me, but it's my understanding that when the ACCC Part 2 was launched, that the ASPPB did commit to, sort of having these ongoing discussions with stakeholders and gathering information and making an informed decision at some point in the future. So that decision was made on October 28th that effective January 1 of 2026, the ACCC will now consist of, or then consist of, two required components, Part 1 knowledge and Part 2 skills. So there was some dialogue between the board members and with Dr. Flint relative to these developments. And that is where we sort of left the conversation.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Dr. Flint, is there anything that you wanted to add to that summary?
Madam Chair, members of the board, no, I think that's a very accurate overview. And I just want to express my appreciation for you even to be having this conversation. It shows the value that you put in ASPA's opinions, and I just wanted to express that thanks.
Right. And Michelle, I think some of us expressed concerns of the lack of, when we agreed to this years ago, and Dr. Malott gave a great review of how we got here. My understanding, because I remember someone from ASPPB coming to the board talking about it, but there's no study guide. There's nothing these students have to gauge this test on. There's a lot of frustration, a lot of retaking of the test. And it just doesn't seem as though ASPPB is providing guidance or taking into account these issues, as well as Dr. Flint also added that they haven't been able to receive any data from ASPPB in regards to the test taking. And it's just my opinion, I'm a little concerned about future students or, our future practitioners who maybe are getting frustrated, maybe go to a different state, not being able to obtain their license, because maybe we're not as prepared or ASPPB is not prepared for these individuals to take the test. They don't even have study materials yet.
So could I comment, Ms.?
Yes, Dr. Malott.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on one point, Dr. Mishri, and that is, since I serve on the application review committee, I don't have data in front of me. I do see I've been on it continuously now for the last few months, or almost continuously. And I'm seeing way more retakes for Part 1. I'm seeing maybe, I don't know, but it's not based on scientific fact. And I'm wondering whether our board can just provide just a summary, whether it's, Ms. Galvin thinks that's even allowed, because we're not revealing names and things, but, for all the people reports. But it's still very, very few. So when we say there's been lots of failure, I can count it on one hand, So I just wanted to make that point.
You can count on one hand the number of people that have failed the test?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because every retake comes back before the application review committee and we review it. As I said, I still see similar percentages for Part 1, but not for Part 2. The majority have passed. We've had a couple. That's just my, it's anecdotal because I'm not,
I agree.
Yeah, Dr. Catarino's with me on that committee a lot.
Madam Chair, does the board wish to hear some data that I have analyzed to help inform this discussion potentially?
Yes. Would it need to be in a session, or can we share that?
Let's ask Ms. Galvin. So I can report the number of takers. I can report the average number of attempts among those takers to achieve a passing score. I can also speak to any potential possible outliers that may be included in this data set. Can I speak to
that? That would be great. I would love that because I said mine's anecdotal.
So my data is a week old, but I think it's probably fairly current. 42 takers. The average number of attempts to achieve a passing score is 1.28. We have two outliers who are impacting to some degree that average. One of the outliers, I don't know if I can say this, it's a very unusual situation. I will say that. The other outlier is no longer a candidate.
So would you say, Ms. Pakkanen, about anywhere between 35 and 40 have passed on the first attempt?
I can pull that data and take a look at it, if you'll indulge me.
So I just wanted that for the record. You know, I'm very concerned about study materials and things, but there's a lot of myth out there too, so.
And do you have that for part one? If it is harder.
The part one, Dr. Caterino, the data, national data is available on their website. And the pass rate, I don't know about Arizona, but it's 70%. They break it into four categories, first time takers, people who take it many years out, accredited programs, non-accredited programs. So.
Madam Chair, just one other observation for what it is worth. If Arizona has 42 takers, we know that the other two U.S. jurisdictions, there are Canadian jurisdictions who are requiring part two, but three U.S. jurisdictions requiring part two, Nevada, Georgia, District of Columbia, I would surmise that if we have 42 collectively, they have at least that much. So we should be approaching the point where ASPPB will start looking at the data that they have promised to us. What I've heard is that I've heard the same thing the board has, which is we will report data. And I think we all are very eager to have that. I'm hoping that particularly as what I'm seeing in our jurisdiction anyway, is that there's an acceleration for ACPPP part two to be a requirement. In the beginning, it was just, you know, one registrant or one candidate, and then a few months, and then there would be another one. And then so now that that's picking up some steam, I would assume we're getting closer to that number and that the point in time at which ASPPB can say, now here's the data that you all want.
So what was it out of 42? How many passed?
I looked at the average number of attempts required to pass. It is 1.28. And that is, again, factoring in the two, I'm calling them outliers, which one has very unusual circumstances.
So are we saying then our percentage of passing is like the 90%? I'm trying to just put it in more in a percentage of passing.
I'm filtering it wrong. Hold on a moment. I'm trying to do this quickly and I'm not, this is taking longer than I had hoped. I have to filter for the part two, so bear with me. So we have 69 are passing on their first attempt.
69%.
Correct. And so about another 28 are passing on their second attempt.
And what is the cost of the exam again?
Ms. Folks, do you recall what the cost of the examination is? If not, I'll look it up.
The last time I checked, it was $400, but that may have gone up. Let me take a quick look. I've got that bookmarked.
Thank you. While Ms. Folks is looking up that information, may I offer, again, we've discussed that this board has already articulated an interest in, we need a statute change in order to permit early entry to take part one. But I heard a resounding chorus of support for moving forward with a request for that change. One other consideration that this board may want to make is that when a reapplication is required because of the need, you know, to retake ECPP part two, I would be very comfortable making a recommendation to the board to substantially decrease the $200 fee to something even quite nominal, just to try to bring, you know, a little bit more relief to the financial aspect of this requirement.
And that would be the board fee. The exam fee is to a third party, correct?
Correct. So board staff has discussed the fact that particularly as we make the shift to online applications, it will continue to streamline and minimize the time required of board staff to process and create a reapplication file. So shrinking the fee from 200 to 50 to 25, whatever the board, you know, determines is appropriate, that is acceptable. You know, from a fiscal perspective, we would just need to make a rule change.
Madam Chair, board members, I've shared my screen that shows the exam and test center fees. So part two is until August 15th, 2023 is $300 per sitting. And then the test sitting fee is $87.50. And then after August 15th, 2023, it goes up to $450. And part one has been $600 for a while.
And Madam Chair, just to clarify, so the test sitting fee is paid to, excuse me, Pearson, not to ASPPB.
Is that who owns the copyright? Is that?
I think it's the test center, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, test center?
Yeah. Yes. ASPPB owns the copyright to the exam and administers it, and they partner with Pearson View Test centers.
Thank you.
I still have a concern regarding adding more obstacles to applicants. I have to go back to the University of Arizona, and if someone could contact them and see where they got their figures, that would be great, Heidi. But they're saying that if there's a 95% pass rate on two of the people who have taken ECPP one, then it's redundant, and why do it? I understand that historically, because I was a part of that, that the board, the second part of the board would be for applicants would be an interview And that was the skills part. And now to avoid that and the subjectivity, I understand that we're trying to make it more of a psychometric. We're trying to pound it into a psychometric approach. But if it's that redundancy in the past, anyhow, why do it? Is one concern. The second concern is that, you know, at what point will we just close the funnel and prevent anyone from coming into the profession? I think it's counterproductive. We certainly want to weed out the bad apples, the bad actors, the ones that are not prepared to go out into the public. But is this overkill? And again, if ASPPB is the primary push for this, and they've already made that determination, if they only have three jurisdictions that are requiring it, they're basing a lot on their ability to force the jurisdictions into compliance. And I just have a problem with that.
Madam Chair, committee members, if I may, this is Kathy. The concept of redundancy is a theory, not proof. That my observation in, you know, because I download these scores and report them to the and send the official letter, so I'm very familiar with these. And what my anecdotal observation has been is that those who are prepared to pass part one are also prepared to pass part two. Those who have trouble passing part one are not as prepared, and they are not as prepared with their skills either, and tend to need more attempts to pass part two. I do not believe claiming that it's redundant is a valid observation.
So if the ones who are prepared to pass part one have greater success in passing part two, and those that are not prepared to pass part one will fail at part two, even that anecdotal observation continues to be a concern for redundancy, because it's still, if they're not passing part one anyhow, they don't get a license.
True. If I may, I used to work for the osteopathic board, and their exams measure, they have three parts, and one of those parts actually has two parts to it. One is a knowledge exam and one is a skills exam. And measuring both is a common practice in other professions. And I've seen those firsthand as well. And the idea that a psychologist has not only the knowledge base, but is also skilled in the practice of psychology, I believe, if I remember correctly, that was the board's concern and support for both parts. And I think that Heidi can correct me, but I believe there were some town halls that were presented that went into detail about what was being measured on the skills exam and how it differed from the knowledge exam. And I wonder if it's possible, does the board need to perhaps review that information so they have a full picture?
And Madam Chair, if that's the case, I have supplied a recording of the town hall in previous executive director reports. I'm happy to do that again. If now that there's, you know, maybe a more compelling reason to take a close look at that information. There is also, and I haven't actually looked at this
closely in terms of mapping the concerns articulated in the email that's in wide circulation with the factual overview that ASPPB issued in conjunction with its notice about the shift to a two-part, two-component examination in 2026. There's a seven-page document that was supplied as a companion piece. I wish I could remember from the meeting if ASPPB had indicated that this is a line-by-line response to the concerns. I don't know that that's the case, and I certainly don't want to represent it that way, but it's just additional information, I think, that, you know, the board should consider.
Other thoughts, Mr. Nguyen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just kind of confused again. Excuse my naivety on this issue, because I'm kind of new to this whole thing. But what is the purpose of this conversation? Is it to, you know, obviously to listen to the Arizona Psychologists Association? But is it to potentially write a letter to ASPPB, or is it to go in a different direction? What are we trying to accomplish with this conversation? Because, and I ask this because in the end, they're changing this by 2026. It looks like they're on a path to do it, even though only three other states currently do, I guess, the second part of this. Is that the purpose of this conversation, is to determine what, if anything, we write a letter? Is that what we're trying to accomplish here?
I think there was a second part to the, there was another part about some relief in terms of the fees. And then, of course, more information on the study materials. So there were several requests towards the end of the ASPAS letter.
So the goal is to essentially draft a letter of some concern of certain elements of integrating the second part of this test by 2026.
It's up to the board to do that. That is, you know, but going back to the documents, I'll need to go back. Let's see. Oh, I got to find the email again.
I think we're here to address the letter that we received from Dr. Flint's organization, which had to do with the fees, which we only have the state fees we can deal with. The concern of the lack of study guide and the lack of data, although I think Ms. Packerton gave us at least an overview of the data that we know of, which isn't terrible, 70% pass. I don't know how that, I don't know. Is that good, bad? I don't know.
Well, without any study guides.
Right, without any study guides. So I guess that's not too bad. I think Ms. Packenon did mention that we could reduce the fee.
And maybe that's one action we could take, you know, to provide some relief.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, we would be reducing to, again, I'm fine with to a significant degree, the reapplication fee. So, I mean, obviously someone who's reapplying, they are forced to pay a fee to retake an examination. So if we can at least do what's under our authority, which is reduce the cost of the reapplication, great. You know, let's move forward with that rule revision at our earliest opportunity. We do have some other potential rulemaking matters to consider. So this could all be rolled into one rulemaking.
So Ms. Packenin, the actual fee amount is in rule?
Yes, correct.
So it's not just that we charge a fee?
Correct.
Okay. So you'd have to get the rules approved before you can make that change.
Correct. Although we may ask Ms. Galvin if there are any circumstances under which the board might have authority to waive fees. That has been done recently, of course, but we did so under the board did so, excuse me, under the auspices of a declared emergency. So that is that's a question that I don't pretend to have an answer to. If we can just, the board can just sort of decide, you know, we don't feel this fee is appropriate or warranted or necessary, and therefore we waive it.
I got a question on the ASPPB. So just, and I'm not a psychologist, so I'm just trying to just figure out how this all relates. So if you have a national organization saying we want this rule done by a certain day, you have to take the EPPP 1 and 2 by whenever the year was. If the states do not agree to it, they can still license. You're still a psychologist. We would still give a license out to that psychologist. They just wouldn't be a member of that association. Where's the correlation there between you have to? I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah. In 2026, part one and part two become part of the same exam. So if a board requires an exam, a person will have to do both parts. Right now, they can just choose to do one part and still meet the exam requirement that almost every board has in their statutes. But in 2026, there is no choice. If somebody registers for the exam, in order to pass the exam, you have to do both parts. And that's where, because it's just one exam.
But it's just going to be one exam. But then I thought we changed it so we allowed you to take that exam when you finished your schooling and you didn't have it.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have the skill sets then, would they? Because they haven't done the supervisory hands-on.
No, they do. We have 1,500. We have close to, 1,500 required before.
So does every state say you have to pass the EPPP exam to be a psychologist?
Pretty much. I cannot think of a jurisdiction that doesn't have.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, may I cite the statute that requires a passing score on the examination? 2072A is our statute language that requires the an applicant to pass the examination. I'm sorry, there was another question or point that Ms. Shreve made that I was going to respond to, or maybe it was Dr. Malat. It's gone. Hopefully I remember it.
What was the number again? Excuse me, Ms. Bakkanen.
32-2072, subsection A. A jurisdiction may elect to develop, maintain, update, administer its own examination if it determines that for whatever reason it does not wish to require the ASPPB's EPPP.
But real quick, there is no real developed alternative to the EPPP at all. It's essentially this or nothing, and then they're imposing upon the all states by 2026. That's the reality of things, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not trying to rush this conversation at all, because I think this is an important conversation to have. In fact, I think it's one of the more important things that the board discuss is access to essentially psychologists in the state of Arizona. So I think it's critically important, but I'm also trying to think, like, what can we do within the powers that are given to us and what exists via statute? And to me, it's obviously the cost is a problem. So anything that we can do on our end, and then anything that we can push and recommend and write a letter to ASPPB to reduce the cost on their end would be helpful. I will just say for the record, I'm not even supportive of the EPPP part two at all. I assume that the system was working okay before adding this additional barrier for folks becoming psychologists in the state of Arizona. So if it was just me writing the letter, I would also just express opposition to the entire plan of unilaterally opposing this upon states.
Ms. Pecta.
Madam Chair, I'm so sorry. I'm hearing concerns articulated about, you know, access to care, availability of services and all those kinds of things. I just want to remind the board, and believe me, I'm not presenting this as the magic bullet or the panacea to all of these things, but with the planned shift or the planned addition of the APA, the American Psychological Association, to accredit master's level psychology programs, qualifying programs in the future. That is intended to be one potential strategy for jurisdictions to consider, that at some point in the future, jurisdictions may wish to modify their practice acts in order to create a licensure pathway, qualifications for licensure for individuals who for whom their terminal degree happens to be a master's degree. So that may be something that the board, I think this board wants to monitor that closely. I'm on the task force for ASPPB that's looking very closely about how that might look in terms of model language for jurisdictions to consider. Currently 17 jurisdictions license master's level professionals. Their scope is prescribed differently. The EPPP passpoint requirement is different. So it's scaled, if you will. We are one of the 34 jurisdictions that does not license master's level individuals. So I'm sure that's a conversation this board is going to be having at some point, the appropriate point in the future. So, and you know, I'm on the task force, both wearing my administrative hat and also to learn how to bring the best information I can back to you to inform your future decision.
Additional questions or thoughts? Dr. Medina.
Thank you. So my question is, do we have data on how has requiring the EPPP Part 2 impacted the applications for licensure in terms of yearly applications that we get, for example?
Madam Chair, do you want me to speak to that?
Yes, please.
I have looked at that data. I assemble and report that data with our budget submission every year to the Governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Development. And it's also part of our strategic plan update. So on an annual basis, I am to report the certain metrics, certain performance metrics of ours. We have seen a dip in applications recently. What we don't know is to what do we attribute that that reduction in psychologist applications? Is it attributed to COVID? Is it attributed to the fact that this board for 18 months, I believe it was, accepted temporary emergency license applications? And some of those individuals obviously elected that simpler pathway for practice authorization versus applying for the full license. What about SIPACT? Is SIPACT also having an impact on applications because of the ability to achieve an authorization to practice across jurisdictions? So there's other factors that could be at play. I mean, quite frankly, the EPPP Part 2 could be among them. We just don't gather any information to inform us about that, those levels or those fluctuations, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
Additional comments? I mean, any discussion on kind of next steps aside from, I know, the recommendation of potentially reviewing the legislation coming up in the updated legislation? Do we want to direct this back to the legislative committee, or what kind of?
I wanted to make another point. When I'm reviewing some of the statements that have been made, and again, I'm not wearing the ASPPB hat. I'm definitely going to need to get direction on how much I can say or not, but I've been involved with this issue for the last 15, 16 years. So we struggle with this issue. So this didn't come out of the blue. You know, as I said, for 17 years, we've been thinking, especially as boards started to drop their oral exam because of the problems with the oral exam. So this didn't come out of the blue. The oral exam was a huge barrier, and yet our state supported it. And I, I remember many, many, many students, highly competent, failing that oral exam, and eventually we dropped it. But that was individual. It wasn't through ASPPP. Each state had their own oral exam. So then this move came about. And so ASPPP is made up of board members like myself. So they're not people sitting out there are not part of the regulation. Well, every ASPPP member has to be part of a regulation committee. So they're not, they're representatives of the whole obviously. So what I'm saying is they're not legislators or government officials sitting down there making these regulations. So just wanted to make that one point. The other thing is what happens with these kind of regulations, because board members turn over every 5 years, it seems like a new issue each time we have newly elected members. It doesn't seem like it's an ongoing thoughtful deliberations and discussions that have been going on. Ms. Shree remembers some of the discussions that happened. Dr. Bohansky was a very vociferous supporter of this exam, really wanting us to be similar to the medical board and the osteopathic board, as Ms. Folks talked about, and the physical therapy board. They all have practice exams, skill-based exams. And ASPPB, any doctoral level, we're the only doctoral level licensing organization that doesn't have a skill exam. And we did, we tried to, it failed. And then this was the work that has been going on for about 15 years before this exam came about 2 years ago. So that's the historical context. And it's hard though, you know, and this is happening across the country, as board membership changes, there's very few people like me who happens to be on the board for this long and who can remember the history. Almost everybody is new. And so it's like starting all over again. So that's also a context of this type of situation where we are today. So.
And I agree with that. I think the board composition also kind of lends to a little bit of a different lens. We kind of tabled this item to make sure that Jean was available. It doesn't sound like anybody has any questions for Jean, but Jean, do you have any statements you would like to make on it?
I do not, except to say that it's certainly within the board's discretion to decide what course it's going to take with respect to part two, whether that's to stay the course and keep the status quo, continue requiring part two, or, you know, get off the road and wait till January 1st of 2026. It's certainly within your discretion. You also can table the matter if you believe that there is additional information possibly out there that you would want staff to look into, or other sources, or hear from other stakeholders, or hear from ASPPB directly.
Thank you. Mr. Nguyen.
Madam Chair, so I guess hearing it from Ms. Galvin, I guess we have a decision on whether we're going to implement and start doing the EPPP part two now versus 2026. And if is that an option? And if that's an option, I'd rather delay it till 2026. If we're going to be forced upon it, let's delay it for a few years.
We already do it.
Well, Dale.
Sorry, Mr. Nguyen. It was a good thought there, but
yeah, we're already doing it.
We should have clarified that the board, with the early adoption decision, the effective date for requiring the EPPP predated you, which was November 1st of 2020.
Yeah.
We're one of
the, if I was only put on the board earlier, I
would. Yeah. We are one of the three states.
Oh, we're right. Great. Okay.
Right. It's four jurisdictions, U.S. jurisdictions, three Canadian jurisdictions.
Fun. Okay.
All right. Any additional thoughts? Any wishes?
I would be in agreement that we can review lessening the fee. And I know that's going to take a while because it's through a rule process. So that's never a quick process. But is that something we would look at on today's agenda? Is that agenda size, or we have to look at that or move on that later?
You could request staff to start exploring that option and to look at any potential fiscal impact of reducing the fee.
Right.
They could come back to you at a future meeting with proposals.
Yes, and Madam Chair, Ms. Shreve, we're going to be assuming that today's meeting will resolve potential statute revisions that we want to move forward. The Legislative and Rules Committee will be able to shift soon, as soon as I can assemble you, into the next meeting, which will focus on rule changes. So this will be on the list.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So just to be clear, at this point, we could not say we will not require the EPPP2 until it's required on January 1st, 2026. We could not move in that direction.
I think we could as a...
We could.
My point is
of relief.
I think our applicants are at a disadvantage from other states because there are no study materials. There is no data. It's a mystery. When I've had my trainees ask me about it, my honest answer is, well, I don't know much. And it's really, really difficult to find any kind of information other than very few folks that have taken it. And, you know, many passed, some didn't. But ultimately, I think our applicants, right, or any of the other two states and DC, you know, are being sort of the guinea pigs to then implement it on January 1st, 2026. And I'm not sure how fair that is because they did not put out study materials. No. There's nothing for them to prepare. I mean, it may be by 2026, there will be, but again, that is not, I don't.
Mr. Wynn?
Yeah, I agree with you, Dr. Medina. And honestly, I think it would send a pretty powerful signal to ASPPB, too, that the one of the three states that was in it is backed out of it. And I'd be supportive of that direction, even if it's only for 4 years and we get forced upon it in 2026.
Dr. Millat?
I was just going to say, you know, what we heard at the meeting, Heidi, Jennifer, myself, Todd, that there will be a practice test in January. And I'm wondering whether we should look at it in January and then make that decision, you know.
Yeah. By what date in January?
I don't know. That's what we heard, Heidi. I don't know if you heard a date.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Madam Chair, we may want to bring ASPPB back. I am ill-equipped to answer questions. I am definitely sensing Dr. Millat's trepidation to, given her new role. So I think in the past, and granted, we've brought Dr. Turner before us, for other reasons, but we may want to bring or invite ASPPB's governance representative or representatives to a board meeting just to so you have all of the information you might want to consider.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Oh, yes, sorry, your little picture was gone.
I kind of like the direction we're hearing a little bit. Like, I do now feel like we're a little bit of a guinea pig. And, I think our intent was good, truly do. I was on those meetings. I truly felt like, but I kind of remember that the ASPPB would have more information study guides, you know, and are we doing the right thing? I would recommend that we ask them to be at the next meeting or January, where we can meet with them and put on the agenda a discussion about whether we want to continue this and have them be part of that discussion. Let them know ahead of time what our concerns are so they can be thoroughly be addressed. And I'm sure we'll have questions, but then at that point, put on the agenda a discussion whether we want to continue or not. We may not, but I think at that point we've looked at the issue. Mr. Nguyen?
Madam Chair, I think that's probably a good compromise approach going forward. I think you know where I stand on it. I'd rather get out of this now. but if you want to hear from ASPPB at the next meeting, I'd be okay with that compromise. I feel like, you know, reading over the board materials, they were pretty thorough in their response on why they thought it was needed, why they thought the concerns of others were not valid. So I'm not sure how much more they're going to cover and how many questions I would have for them, because I'm fundamentally opposed to the, I guess, the principle of requiring this part two to begin with. So, but in a spirit of compromise, I'd be okay with having them come in so we can talk about it further before we make a decision or decide to make a decision in that way.
And I think we should invite then also ASPA to have comment, you know, be part of that discussion too, or be available for that part of that discussion.
Dr. Catarino.
Do we know how many other states might even approve it by beginning of next year? How many are in the process? And also, I wonder what kind of reaction you'll get from the people that had to take part two. If then we say, now nobody has to take it. I don't know. And then we have to take it again in 3 years. I don't know if that's going to be a problem.
If they passed it already, I don't think they'd have to take it again.
No, but the ones that failed, and then people say, why did I have to study for it? And now other people don't. But anyway, but I'm wondering, too, if it's going to be more than three in the next couple of months, if we're close to the point where other states and areas will be requiring it.
They should be able to address that, too, when they're here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They wouldn't know.
Do we need that as a recommendation? Does that need to be or is that just a staff suggestion? Do we need a consensus, Ms. Galvin?
I'm not hearing any objection. And I think Heidi has direction as to who to invite at the next meeting that'll accommodate the speakers.
Perfect. Well,
in the meantime, it's status quo.
Yeah, we will table this. Thank you, Dr. Flint, for being here. And we will move on to the next agenda.
Can I bring up one point? I heard, could we make a decision on the fee to the, at least make a recommendation on that one particular aspect? Because I think that would provide some financial relief.
I believe there was a discussion that directing staff to look into that, and Heidi the fiscal impact, but I think the direction that Heidi has heard is that to commit that process.
Okay.
All right, any other comments? Hearing none, we do have Dr. Davey back.
There's a second part that we haven't discussed. We focus on part two, and that is, which is one I've been very interested in and been part of the discussions with Dr. Flint in a separate subcommittee. And that is, the part one, taking it earlier. I think that has to be a board decision. We can't just, and then maybe board staff can work on process.
You mean take it earlier, meaning when you get out of school? I thought we talked
Take it before you even go on internship.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm not sure it's on that agenda to discuss part one.
Oh, it isn't?
No, I don't think
so.
Heidi has a hand up.
Ms. Peckman.
Madam Chair, so that is a one of the recommendations under agenda item 15, which we'll be moving to shortly.
Oh, okay. It's a different item. Okay.
Correct.
Perfect. All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, before I forget, Ms. Galvin, we did not do agenda item number 5, the council update. Do you have any update for the board?
On my way for a comfort break, but I heard you. So the council report really is just that we do have the formal hearing in the McCall matter set for the 17th, and I don't have anything other than that.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Galvin? All right. Hearing none, we will now go to agenda item number 15. Ms. Pacman, will you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. So at the last meeting, the board reviewed a series of recommendations from the Legislative and Rules Committee, and they are depicted in a chart that begins on page 3 and continues to page 4 of your PDF. So to highlight one of those recommendations, it is the which one is it? So it's the third from the bottom. It's sort of in the middle of page 4 at 32.2072C that we would like to modify that statute in order to allow an applicant to elect to take part one closer to the time that they acquire the knowledge. So that's the early entry discussion that we've been having. So this would be optional. If a candidate wished to, they could wait until the completion of the internship, the dissertation had been defended, the degree had been conferred, all of those things. They can wait and take part one if they so choose, but they can elect with the statute change to take it very close to the time that they are finishing their coursework. So this is something that ASPPB has been urging jurisdictions to consider, and they do have data to show that when testing is conducted closer to the time the education is acquired, it only stands to reason that the performance on the assessment is higher. So we think that by making this change, it's quite likely that we are going to see fewer instances where we have applicants who are not successful on their first, second, third attempts. And so that's where we're seeing, as our data is suggesting, that the cost of testing is becoming a problem for some. So there are a series of other recommendations here, and we had approved all of them, or the board had approved all of them, but there was one outstanding item that we are revisiting today. So we're hoping that as a result of this conversation, we'll have the complete package to take to a sponsor. In all likelihood, it will be whoever ends up to be chairing the House and the Health and Human Services Committee in either the House or the Senate. So once the election is over, that will be clear relatively soon. So the one piece that we were still sort of stuck on is on the second page of your chart. It's the second to last line under temporary licenses. We were looking for a possible title to bestow on someone who was granted a temporary license. So currently we call them temporary license holders. There are some historical records that board staff has found that indicated at some point in time we were using a title of hold on a moment, it was the licensed associate psychologist. And so staff was kind of confused by, you know, why there was a period of time where that license appeared to have been granted, and then it stopped. So Dr. Cindy Olby, my predecessor's predecessor, who was the ED of this board for a long time, she happened to be at your last meeting, and we kind of put her on the spot and said, Dr. Olby, what do you remember of this? She said she didn't recall this history or any of this history. However, later that day, she contacted me because she recalled that in November of 2014, this board had elected and adopted a motion to call temporary license holders licensed associate psychologists. When then the board had attempted to formalize that title in board rule, that was unsuccessful because of the lack of statutory authority to use that term. So in my mind, we've come full circle. We're back to where we need to be in terms of here's an opportunity to establish in statute a title for temporary license holders. I hope that made sense. That the lobbyist is nodding, I think that's a good sign, right?
Ms. Pacnon and Ms. Michelson, I just sent you guys a text. I am, Dr. Davey, if you wouldn't mind leading this discussion for just a moment, my phone is blowing up by family members, and so I need to just make sure that everything's okay. So if one of you could take over, that would be much appreciated. Sorry. Dr. Davey, you are muted if you were so kind of involved. Thank you.
Mr. Moline.
So the goal here is just to see if the board supports both of these recommended changes to go before legislative committee, right? Okay. I guess I'll let some more discussion before I make a motion. Because I support both of those.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that there's anything too crazy here. Any other comments from board members?
I missed the second thing. Because you said two. What was the second?
The second statutory change, Heidi, correct me if I'm wrong, I'll try to sum up what you said there, is essentially allowing the board to come up with a title for somebody who holds a temporary license.
Oh, that other matter. Okay, the second matter. Okay.
Yeah. I can make
them up. Yes, Dr. Katarina.
No, I've been at, ASPPB meetings in the past, and I tried to get my students to take the test because there were some states that have said, allowed it at master's level. And I think that's a great idea, as long as we can say that they passed their coursework and their comprehensive exam. At that point, it would be great to take the EPPP, I think, the part one, at least. And now the second point, are we saying that we want to change it from temporary to be associate? Is that where that's going? I was confused on that when I read it. Instead of saying temporary psychologist, you want to say associate
psychologist.
I would rather keep temporary because it's clear than because they may not pass the test, and then they already could apply to other states and say, well, this is associate psychologist, or I don't know. I think it's better to say temporary because it does have a year time limit.
I think one of the concerns was that you can have someone that, let's say, doesn't take the EPPP, and they just are going to continue to work under the supervision of somebody, so which we have seen sort of in the past. And so is it associate a better
term? Well, I thought the temporary had the one-year limit. No.
Madam Chair, committee members or board members, no, the temporary license is valid for 36 months, which matches the postdoctoral statute in 32-2071, subsection G. So it's a 3-year license.
Oh.
Can it be renewed further after 3 years?
No, it cannot.
Okay, because in the counselor world, some people are like permanently licensed associate counselors. Oh. They never ever move out of that status,
But I think using temporary shows that there is an end to it, where psych associate doesn't. So I think it shows that it's not 1 year, but it's 3 years. And unless they go ahead and take the test, that's it.
But if they don't take the test and they can continue working under a supervisor though, right? I thought that's what we're talking about, a temporary. If you have someone that's working under a supervisor, because you don't have to take the EPPP, you could always just work under a supervisor, because we've seen that. And then that would be an associate.
But then, well, I didn't know that. And I thought then they're using the word psychologist. I thought that's not right.
Well, your so associate psychologist, Ms. Packenot, isn't that what we're referring to?
Mr. Chair, so I maybe just to sort of explain what we understood from the Legislative and Rules Committee was that they were looking for a title to draw a distinction between people who were granted that temporary license for up to 36 months. The temporary license then terminates if they either pass or fail the ACCP. But the importance was to make a distinction between those individuals who were granted this temporary authorization to work under supervision and distinguish it from someone else who doesn't have it. And so the public is fully informed or better informed anyway by virtue of the application of that title. I don't know that, we are seeing a historical an idea from history about what to call these individuals. More recently, the Legislative and Rules Committee came up with a little bit different of a variation, but I think it's up to this board to decide what title do you want, if at all.
Can we clarify, though, we're talking about a title for those that are holding the license for 3 years, mm-hmm. not the people that have maybe not passed the test and who are just working under someone's license.
Precisely.
Okay. So if you have a 3-year license, the temporary, then we're going to call them, you want to call them associate psychologists. But if you pass that 3 years and now you're just working under someone's license, you have a PhD, you're working under license, then what are we calling them?
Nothing.
We're calling
it. Well, that is a gray area, Ms. Shree. Okay.
And that's why
I'm always worried about, because once somebody meets their postdoc supervision,
right,
they apply, and then by the time they take the exam, if they don't apply for the temporary status, they're kind of in this gray area, and our statutes don't address that. I've brought this up before,
and I thought that
it always worries me because they're not under supervision, but yet they're not licensed, mm-hmm. and they're not like the temporary people.
Okay. I didn't know they could work under other people if they were in a postdoc or an intern.
We've had those cases in front of us.
Oh. Yeah,
they had a complaint, and they've already met their supervision. So that's not who we're talking about then, right?
No, we're not talking about them.
We're just talking about those that got the 3-year temporary license. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, board members, if I may.
Yes.
The one you're talking about where they are practicing under another licensed psychologist, that's from the exemption statute that's allowed under 32-2075. Subsection A6, and the statute just states that they have to use a title that demonstrates their trainee status. And so one of the other issues that has come up is I've had emails from temporary license holders who are asking what title they can use. And because of 32-2084 that makes using the term psychologist or psych, any derivative of psycho in a title is a class 2 misdemeanor, that it would have been or would be very helpful to our licensed temporary psychologists under supervision to have a distinctive title for them that allows them to use psychologist in some form or manner. Mm-hmm. And the additional aspect of that was, and it just left my mind. Never mind.
Well, couldn't they just say temporary psychologist?
That was it. The issue for me came up because of COVID and we were issuing temporary licenses. It became confusing to the public,
right,
because we had the temporary licenses that were an independent practice level, and then we had the temporary licenses. So I started using supervised temporary license on a regular basis to make a distinction. And now we're having the telehealth registry, which is not a temporary license, but that one's the one that's going to be just for 1 year and then they have to renew. I just feel strongly that if we ever have another situation like we did with COVID and we start issuing temporary licenses, our supervised temporary license holders really need to have something that distinguishes them from any other temporary license.
I like supervised temporary license. That was great.
I would go associate because I think that they're going to be, I mean, it's, they're going to be, it's an associate position, right? It's not temporary. The idea is they're not a temporary psychologist. They're, I mean, they are psychologists. They're an associate working to get there.
But if they don't pass after the 3 years, then they're not a psychologist.
So I have a question. You know, we did pass this this title, temp licensed associate psychologist, back in 2014. But then what happened? Why didn't we use it? I think there's a story behind that that I don't know.
Heidi mentioned that already, that we didn't have the right to because it's not in the statute. So that's what we're trying to do. Is
put it okay. It's not in the statute. Okay. Sorry. Right.
That's okay.
I was distracted. So.
And I do have a question. What would be sort of the rationale for not make it sort of renewable, kind of like the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners? They have, you can be an associate counselor for many, many, many years. That indicates that they are under supervision. They cannot operate independently and, you know, they, you know, have time.
Did that, and would that resolve our issue with those that don't take the test and they're always just under someone's
under supervision? Then right. They do have a title, and if they want to have that title for 1 year while they finish postdoc, then they can. If they want to hold a title for 12 years because for their own reasons, they could, because they are required to be under supervision, and that actually makes us, you know, have a, I think, a I don't know that it's a closer eye, but, you know, if someone doesn't have that title, that means they're, I don't know.
And they're under our jurisdiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they have applied to the board.
Thank you. We've
approved their application, and they have to meet additional requirements.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
So should we have a put this on agenda, or do we need to broaden it maybe to then anybody under supervision? I mean, would that take care of Dr. Malott, the concern we have with those that are just forever under someone's supervision?
Mm-hmm. They do need to have an application to the board. That's the critical part of this. You know, we have many licensee holder that doesn't come before the board till they have finished all their supervision, and then they turn in an application. So we have that situation, you know, where, because we don't regulate that. I mean, they can choose to apply soon after they graduate, or they can wait till they finish their postdoc and then apply. So, because one of the things we don't do, I mean, we do it after the fact, but we don't, and we do it for temporary. But many states actually regulate supervision. So you actually have to submit a supervision plan before you can supervise, and your supervisor needs to be an approved supervisor in the state. We don't look at that right now.
Yes, we don't have any proof that they're being supervised. Is that it?
No. They have to submit that once they complete. But what I'm saying, like in California, before you start your postdoc, you have to have that approved. I mean... Oh.
But after the postdoc, I'm talking.
Before they start their postdoc.
And no, but I'm saying people that are just working under someone, they don't have. Is there any way to prove that they're being supervised?
No. Well, the forms, but for example, in the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, you cannot start accruing hours towards licensure until you get your associate license. So then it brings everyone under the same jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they can keep it for 10 years, they can keep it for 2 years, but they are still under the jurisdiction, and they cannot start accruing hours
until
they get that license. And I know the state of Utah also has this certified psychology resident, I think is what they call it. And until someone gets that, I believe that's when they can start accruing hours.
Same thing with California, you know, so.
I like that.
It regulates the postdoc a little bit more because, you know, we've had instances of applicants coming before our board, and we look at their postdoc and say, this is not in compliance, you know, so.
But yeah, but I just said that after, as they linger on after postdoc, then they can say they're supervised, but we have no paperwork or forms.
Not if they're under jurisdiction, because then maybe they would have to apply for renewal. It's not automatic. You're not just.
Oh.
And they would have to attest to that they're getting supervision. And
okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but that's a whole, I think that should go before the legislative committee to discuss. I mean, there's a lot of nuances that we haven't thought of. So, I mean, I think it's definitely worth considering, you know. And just in terms of the exam, I might have shared this before the group, but in the counseling, the licensed professional counselor, those students do take the exam in their final semester before they go on internship. And they actually apply directly to the exam company. They don't go through the board. And the university is involved to some extent, and they take the exam, they pass it. And then when they move to a certain jurisdiction, they just transfer the scores, you know, and that kind of saves that whole application kind of process. Might save a little bit of money. I don't know, but definitely something to be considered.
Good, because otherwise people go on for years and they say, I'm going to take the test, and they don't. I think that's great.
The one thing I do want to say, this is just for the record, putting my administrative hat. Academic programs, you know, should never make an outside requirement part of a consideration to pass, to meet the degree requirements. Sometimes people get into that dangerous territory. So, you know, it's encouraged, but it cannot be a requirement of because it's an outside requirement. It's not part of the university. I'm just stating that for the record, because it's my little pet peeve when programs try to do that. Mm-hmm. That's when I used to wear the graduate dean hat. So,
all right. So, Ms. Packenhorn, where do we want to go from here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. What I'm hearing is that this idea isn't quite ready yet for the 2023 session. That's fine. It needs to go back to the Legislative and Rules Committee for additional research and consideration. So I'm happy to do that. So I think what we will need, however, is either a motion or a consensus or some direction for me to when the timing and circumstances are ideal, to bring forward everything else that the board has agreed you want to see in a proposed bill in 2023.
Ms. Galvin, is consensus okay on this, or do we need a motion?
No, it's a consensus. She'll bring it back to you.
Wait, Dr. Davies?
Yes, Ms. Shreve.
I thought we were all kind of, can we just go back to the issue we were just talking about? I mean, I don't want to take it off the table. Mr. Nguyen had made, you know, a comment at the very beginning about maybe are we in agreement that calling a temporary license holder, the person carrying the 3-year license, an associate psychologist? I thought we were all kind of in agreement, except maybe for one, with that. The other issue that maybe we talk about next time around is having to do with those that are in the, you know, the outliers that keep going. I don't know. Did we not?
I don't know. Again, I wasn't 100% on board. I would like to see maybe more research on what other states do. I don't know. But that's just me. You could still get a majority.
I guess my question would be, is there any sense in splitting? I mean, the conversations are, you know, go hand in hand. Is there any sense in really splitting that up? I mean, the information that comes back next time is just going to continue to hopefully move Dr. Catarino into that comfortable situation for the rest of us.
I guess my only concern is you miss a legislative deadline. I mean, these don't come, you know, they meet once a year. So, what is your time frame on meeting that, Heidi?
I think we'll be okay.
You'll be fine.
You'll be good? Okay.
So, and I think the term we talked about is licensed associate psychologist, not just associate psychologist.
I like that. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, so... I'm sorry, I think I need clarity. So the board wants me to move forward with requesting a statute change to bestow upon the temporary license holders this new title, but the other piece, which is would involve the extension of, I see it as a renewal of a temporary application. So that would be decided at a subsequent time.
You have a 3-year thing and then you have our 2-year renewal, right? Is that going to be a problem? You know, because we renew licenses every 2 years, but the temporary, they have to renew, well, they have 36 months.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Katerina, you would just need to prescribe what is the time, what are the time frames that you specify that for those renewal periods? If the initial period is 36 months,
yeah,
you know, maybe it's an ongoing every 3-year renewal. It doesn't have to align with everybody else's renewal period. But okay. I just want to be clear on what we're tackling in 2023 and then what we're considering in the future. If anything, I need clear direction and I'm struggling. Maybe it's me. It's probably me.
All right, who wants to try to summarize? Mr. Nguyen, come on, you're smiling. You want to summarize where we're going?
Yeah, our lobbyist.
Yeah. You got to unmute yourself, though. You know, he's got to pass.
Don't put me in charge of this one. I didn't really care what the title was or any of that. I just wanted all this to move forward because I like all the recommendations.
I like the idea of the associate. What did you call him? Professional associate?
Licensed associate psychologist.
There you go. 3 years.
Wow.
I like that. Dr. Medina, I like the idea of everybody's funneled into that. And you just get a 3-year renewal. So if you don't pass that test or you don't take the EPP, you're always in that group.
And so, Dr. Medina is our training center. You like it. And Dr. Milat as our university person. You are on board with that as well?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's solid for me.
Mr. Chair, board members, if I may.
Yes.
Is it... fair to say that this has to go back to the legislative committee because there's going to have to be a number of different statute changes associated with this?
So, yeah, when we have to identify everywhere we need to stick this language, is that what you mean?
Yeah, because I think, at least in my mind, the exemption statute would need some changes and the violation statute 32-2084. Would need an insertion that allowed for the licensed associate psychologist title, I think. But I'm not sure. That's why I'm thinking legislative committee, since I'm not an attorney.
Mr. Chair, it's been my experience that generally we can provide the direction to legislative council staff and give them a general sense of, we think this issue touches these statutes. And then we sit back and let the experts draft the proposed revisions. And then that's what comes back to the board. I'm afraid that if we refer this to the Legislative and Rules Committee now, assembling that group will slow us down if you really want this to move forward in 2023. That's my concern. And Mr. Nguyen, I think, is more, he's more comfortable with an accelerated process than I think I am. So,
yeah, I mean, if we're going to let the experts go through and then kind of do the analysis of where we would need to make other adjustments, I think that's fine. I mean, no offense to the legislative committee, but that's a big lift to find every single spot. So probably someone that's a little bit more in tune with that would make sense.
Yeah, council does that and they're good at it.
Okay. All right. I think that sounds like direction and consensus.
Thank you. And Dr. Davey, I am back. I was just going to let you complete that. I appreciate that.
Well, you missed me trying to, you know, herd some cats on this one. So,
And I do have a question for clarification. Are we also moving toward having... postdoc hours start accruing once they get that license, because not every postdoc get that license whatsoever.
That is a bigger change that I think we would need to go to stakeholders, because that would require, right now, the number of people who are doing the postdoc is very small. Remember, at one point we were looking and that there were 23. I mean, you're talking about a tiny number. Way more people do it the other way. So I don't think we would be ready to go to that change in January. We could go through this and expand it further, maybe next legislative session. Okay.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. We can now move to agenda item number 16. Ms. Pacanon, would you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. Oh, sorry.
Can I talk about the next CE code word very quickly? Next CE code word is ballot. Ballot. Thank you.
Ballot. Fantastic. Thank you for all the reminders, Ms. Poe. All right, Ms. Pacanon.
Yes, thank you. So the board has two statutes in its chapter, one that authorizes the board to establish the continuing education requirements for psychologists, and another that authorizes the board to establish the continuing education requirements for behavior analysts. And it was under that statutory authority that the board had elected to make a couple of changes, two to the psychologist CE rule, which is to require 4 hours specific to diversity and related content, and then completion of the jurisprudence education tool. And then for the behavior analysts, the change was just specific to our proposed change, just specific to the diversity topics. No jurisprudence education tool for behavior analysts yet. And so this package went before the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. And what I heard during the study session, which is the meeting before the meeting, where questions are posed and clarification is sought and additional information is requested of the agency, what I heard some of the council members articulate were concerns about this, the proposed requirement for diversity topics only. And they were articulated under statutes, not under this board's authority, but the statutes were not they weren't on point to this issue. They had to do with limitations to what sort of training state agencies can provide, and obviously this isn't a state agency provided service. So the statutes were entirely on point or relevant. So that being said, I came to the GIRC meeting a week later, and what I heard were some different concerns that were articulated from the council, which really were quite, policy driven instead of, relating to statutes. So I did hear virtually all the council members speak against the diversity CE. There was some concern that this was a revenue generating mechanism for, some entities, perhaps the association, perhaps others. It didn't resonate with GIRC that it was the association who was advocating for this, and the board saw the value in this as well from a public protection perspective. So it didn't matter what I said. The council said, no, we are not going to approve this revision. And I thought we were in the clear as it related to the JET, but council staff asked the council to whether their concerns also apply to the JET. And so they said, well, yes, actually it does too. So in one swoop, we were the whole rule package, which contained many other changes, some fee eliminations, lots of other, elimination of some rules that were duplicative of statute, the reciprocity rule for BAs, everything else is moving forward, but not these changes. So I didn't hear the council articulate the statutory basis for these, for not supporting these revisions. But council staff provided me with a statement that they believed that it was, it relates to the, we didn't provide any evidence that this was the least regulatory, we were imposing the least level of regulatory burden on our licensees. So I believe that I did speak to that, and I believe I provided proof that in point of fact, we weren't imposing a new regulatory burden. It's the same responsibility. It's just different content. And in fact, we had gone to great extents to ensure that the fiscal impact to the licensee would be nothing or perhaps even reduced by these new requirements, but that the evidence that I supplied was not acknowledged. So we find ourselves now with no requirement for diversity continuing education, and we have a half-developed JET that it seems that we cannot require, at least under the auspices of these rules. This matter does have a little bit of implication for a contract, which I believe in certain circumstances, the board can be briefed about the contract in executive session, and I'm happy to do that. I need Ms. Galvin's, of course, guidance on that. But if the board wants to hear what I've learned relative to the contract element of this issue, happy to do that. And then we can have the other discussion as well about how or whether we move forward.
So legal advice, the contract, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I forgot you were back, Madam Chair.
No, you're good. Go right ahead, Dr. Davey.
So I'm sorry, about a contract, like a signed contract for services, is that what you're referring to? Okay. And then so that's one part of the discussion. And then in terms of like a path forward, does that have to go into with legal advice with Ms. Gordon?
No.
Okay.
And I think we don't have to go into executive session. I think it could be suffice it to say that if we, and Heidi, correct me, if we were to abandon JET because of this GIRC issue, there would be no additional financial implications because of the contract.
Yes, and maybe I'll just sort of say what I was prepared to say. So when... you know, just sort of in, you know, where do we go from here? I did the due diligence in terms of, you know, reviewing the contract with Revolution AMC, speaking to the procurement team about, you know, what this means. And what I learned was that the terms of, you know, doing business with the state of Arizona gives the state agency the option to cancel a contract for convenience. So we have broad latitude to say, nope, we're done. You know, we'll pay for services rendered, but you know, we're not going to continue this contractual arrangement. Revolution AMC has the option to present its case to the board to say, you know, we want out of the contract. Please, you know, excuse us or dismiss us, absolve us of any responsibility under the contract. And the board could make that decision, right? So what we did, though, with respect to this contract, I think we were very smart about it. We designed it in such a way that the board did make an investment into the development of the JET. So those terms are in the process of being delivered on. We are paying for the development, and the development, again, is at least half done. It could be, you know, farther along. What I have from Dr. Turner from Revolution AMC is an assurance, both, you know, expressed orally and in writing, that he does want to finish. He has every intention of finishing the JET. And I think we can all appreciate what those reasons might be, right? So the train is still chugging along, albeit a little bit slower, but we met as recently as a couple of days ago, you know, to continue working on the development. But the contract was smart in that it didn't promise any delivery in terms of the ongoing potential revenue to the vendor. So if JET is developed and it sits, Granted, it does age a little bit, which is a little kind of an issue, and it may require some updating, but it can be put on hold and the board will not suffer any adverse impact from that. And there's no contractual implications. So that's very good. We could find ourselves in a far different situation. And I would take the same risk that we did because of how we constructed this contract. So we will have a jet. We'll have it ready for whenever the board has the authority to require one. And so one strategy that the board may want to think about is whether we seek a statutory revision rather than a rule revision to require the jet.
So can you define the jet? I mean, again, what is it we're purchasing? Is that the test?
It's not a test, Mr. Chair, Ms. Shreve. It's the jurisprudence educational tool. So it is the online on-demand exercise that presents the statute and rule content in question and answer form, and also provides feedback to how those questions are answered. So it's not a high stakes examination by any means. So it can be done with a partner. It can be done in a group. It could be done at 2 a.m. So we've designed it to be a very flexible learning exercise. And we designed it the way that we did because the literature has established that information retention is a much higher rate when it's acquired through an assessment type of exercise versus just reading content.
So just to go back to the rulemaking, though, so mm-hmm. The GIRC said we can't do that. The GIRC said, let's not do that. So we have a contract that was designed that we wanted to put in that. Okay. So,
but Madam Chair, I mean,
how much money have we paid them? How much is our contract worth?
Before we go down this path, though, can we unpack GIRC telling us we can't do something? Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I should not interrupt Ms. Shreve. I apologize.
That GIRC has decision making. That's their authority.
That's wonderful. But in our statutes, I believe there is a section under the continuing education that says we, as this board, decide what is going to be included in, and it needs to be aligned with best practice of what we're doing, current topics in the field. I mean, I don't know how much more this aligns with that particular statute. And which one is it? It's 3220.74E. It essentially states that a person who renews an active license to practice psychology in the state shall satisfy a continuing education requirement designed to provide the necessary understanding of current developments, skills, procedures, and treatment related to the practice of psychology in the amount and during the period the board prescribes.
So the question is, do we have appeals right?
To me, I'm not trying to get into a match with them, but I also think they may not like something, but the fact is that all of our practices as psychologists, there are things that evolve over time that have to be paid attention to, much like why we have right now we have ethics called out. Is ethics also not allowed? They didn't seem to really gravitate towards that. So I just have a hard time just taking their word for it. I mean, I'll pause there.
Mr. Nguyen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Dr. Davy, you're right. And it says it in the paperwork that we have the authority to prescribe continuing education requirements. But then the governor's office, which he's an outgoing governor, of course, so, things all change. They can probably do a few things to us to make things slightly more uncomfortable if we don't follow their recommendations. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the rub there. Yeah, I think we have the authority to say piss off if we want to. But whether that's the right path or not is up for us to decide.
Yeah. And I would say it'd be interesting to look at, particularly around the jet. I mean, I would posit that a significant amount of complaints that come to us are because of failure to understand the rules and statutes in this state.
Absolutely.
And the JET is designed to stop that. So talk about administrative oversight and burden. The JET could curtail a lot of work here that's being done by this group. So,
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Davy, you're exactly right. My conversations with Aaron Aiken and also Ms. Hackinen have been in terms of the numbers of cases that have come before the board, the slippery slope concept of starting out as a clinical case and then quickly devolving into a forensic case, and the JET, some of the questions and some of the topics directly affect that. So I think we'd have fewer complaints if the JET was a tool that was required. You don't have to pass it. You just have to take the, go through the process, and that's all.
And that's the history behind why we got there, but
yeah.
Dr. Medina had a comment. Oh, no. Okay. Mr. Nguyen.
Madam Chair, I mean, if it's not included, because these are essentially prescribing which hours you need for continuing education, it doesn't mean you folks can't still take or go through the JET, right? I mean, they still can. It's just not a part of the more prescribed specific requirements within continued education. So it's not like it's not like provided. It's just not forced within like kind of a more specific requirement within the continuing education requirements. So the course can still exist, right? I mean, the tool can still exist. So, you know, I don't think it's a lost cause that there was money spent on it. It's just that the GIRC, which is such a weird acronym, but the GIRC didn't want to specifically force specific elements within the continuing education. So I don't think it's a loss, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. So, okay. Yeah.
And I guess the question that I have for that too, well, not question, but I guess the comment is, even though it wouldn't be required for renewal, it could be something that we could potentially use to prescribe when we do outline CEs, because I've seen where we've gotten to where like, it would be nice for you to go back and review the law, but how do we capture that in a like professional development type manner? And so I want, you know, I think that that would still be good utilization of the JET when we do run into those circumstances where we're like, but had we just read it, and then being able to use that as something that we recommend for the CEs as part of consent agreements or non-disciplinary letters or something. All right. Any other? Oh, Dr. Malott?
Oh, no. I just sat down from standing.
So, Madam Chair, I'm not hearing the board say is that there doesn't seem to be any interest in revising the statute to require the JET.
It does not appear to be the case now.
And I think, Madam Chair, if I can, and I think also there are other boards that have JETs, if I believe, in the state of Arizona. And I would be interested if that those are requirements. Before I would think we'd want to look. I mean, I get it. GIRC is there to do what they're going to do, right? But I also think it's our job is to protect the public and to be administratively sound. And so I think that some further research by us to either one, go back and make a case for why we'd like to see these things go forward. You know, I think that's a worthwhile exercise without just reacting to their first round of feedback to us, particularly when I hear kind of a summary of what their overall comments and the path that that conversation took. I think they may have missed some of the larger issues that this board deals with versus what's, you know, most recently on the news.
Mr. Nguyen.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea, because perhaps they just weren't aware that, you know, equivalent JETs exist for others. I would just caution that, you know, this seems like this is a Ducey kind of council. He's leaving office. We're going to have a new governor here at the beginning of the year. So, you know, there may not even be a GIRC the next governor. So all this could be, you know, moot. We may just want to see kind of how the election shakes out and kind of where it goes from there and revisit it at the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Ms. Treif.
That's what I was going to mention. Yeah, with the governor changing, a lot of that changes. A lot of those are appointments, a lot of the structure. So I think we kind of wait out until it happens.
I'd be on board with that. I don't feel like I like their answers. So So I'm willing to wait and see if I got to talk to them again or do something else.
Seems like in conversations I had with other jurisdictions recently, most of them talked about tying it to their renewal process. People would do a 15-item quiz or something, you know, and it was open book, but just helping people to be familiar.
Yeah. All right. Oh, Madam Chair.
So we are Ms. Pacnan, sorry.
Thank you. I just wanted to speak to Dr. Davies' point. What we were proposing to do was a bit of a departure from what other Arizona boards have the authority to do, which is to require a high stakes examination. And so this board categorically said, no, we don't want that kind of experience. We want sort of what Dr. Malott was describing, which is, you know, a more supportive learning tool that, you know, isn't daunting. It's, you know, something that could be done. I mean, we hope that professionals engage with one another and have lively conversations about what the statutes say or don't say, or what you think they say or don't say. And this happened. I witnessed this at ASPA's annual convention a couple of months ago. It was very rewarding to see, you know, how much enlightenment, you know, came from just this, you know, experience of small groups together, you know, debating what the right answer was to these questions. So even though we did something that was, you know, less than, I guess, you know, we took a soft touch, right? And so I think that's part of the frustration here was that, you know, this could have been imposed in a very different way, and the board elected to not do that. But I have been having some conversations with my colleagues who have brought matters back before GIRC where they were less than successful on the first attempt. But, you know, they strategized and brought it forward again. So I'm prepared to do that. I think the timing that I'm hearing, the suggested timing, you know, I definitely appreciate that. You know, we sort of need to think about that. And I'm going to call upon our governance leadership to help with this, with the next presentation, because, you know, I'm just the bureaucrat trying to, you know, represent the board's wishes. And if I'm less than effective, then, you know, maybe the leadership will do a better job than me.
Thank you, Ms. Pacnan. For what it's worth, I think you do a wonderful job representing the board's wishes. So thank you for all of your work. All right. Then I suppose we will just table this for a future agenda item, maybe bring it up again after the first of the year so that we can reevaluate the government structure at that time. So any further discussion? Hearing none, we can move to agenda item number 17. Are there any agenda items for future meetings that we have not already discussed? Fantastic.
Well, you know, I have an item, and my item is related to how we review disclosure of really past convictions. Many boards are now trying to modify that, partly because of the re-victimization. People, you know, they did something when they were 18, they were caught with marijuana. Now they're 30 and we make, you know, they have to submit. And we will still require that, our statute requires that, but do we need to bring it up, you know, during our meetings? And so, I don't know, I'd like to discuss how we could go about, because I know it's very embarrassing to our licensees, and we have standards of practice. You know, if it's in the distant past, we generally say, okay, looks like they've learned from their lesson. But I don't know. I'd like to discuss that.
Sounds great. Any additional items? Right, hearing none. Item number 18, adjournment. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you guys so very much. It was a very long, hefty, full meeting. We appreciate all of your guys' time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you.